Oh, technical difficulties in the Bill Austin.
No, I'm kidding. It was just I needed to get the recording started, so I was stalling out for there. Anyway.
I was going to say, nothing ever goes wrong in the Bill Austin.
Nope, not even once. You've heard it here for, on the Review Square this Friday evening. Nothing has ever gone wrong in the Bill Austin radio studio. No, not even once. Yes, thank you so much, Kirsten, for that wonderful reminder.
You're very welcome. This is the news before the news.
Exactly.
Where are they getting their news, though?
No clue. We'll find out.
We'll find out, I suppose. More importantly, what are they listening to right now?
Yes, that's a very good question. You are listening to The Review Squared on Blaze Radio and BlazeRadioOnline.com, live from the Bill Austin Radio Studio in the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism and Mass Communications in downtown Phoenix. And if you're listening wherever you get podcasts, thank you, too. But yes, right now we're live, and we're joined here by a guest, actually, and we'll let her introduce herself in a second, but hi.
Hi, I'm Sarah Nelson. I guess I should mention that Dublin's here, too, which is my dog.
Our extra special guest.
So yeah, it's a two-for-one deal going on.
Yes, and we are glad to have both you and Dublin here today. Anyways, as always, I'm Gideon Kariuki.
And I'm Kirsten Dorman.
And that's the whole panel this week. Both John and Ethan are off doing their busy things, living their busy lives. So we hope to have them both here next week.
Yes, very proud of them both. And Haley is now, for the second week in a row, officially overseas.
She is, which is still kind of unbelievable to me.
I know. Do you think she's eaten fish and chips yet?
I need to ask
Maybe
her that.
Maybe sipped some tea out there?
We will find out. I will let you all know next week.
Yeah, maybe we're a little, I'm at least a little too comfortable poking fun at the British.
No. Don't apologize. That is fair and just. After everything they did to the world, I feel like it's fair we get one on them.
Yeah, they can take a fish and chips joke. They can take a tea joke.
Exactly. So, anywho.
Speaking of big jokes.
Oh, yeah. Speaking of huge jokes, this week I'm talking about the Maricopa County audit, if you can call it that, for what I truly hope is the final time. For those of you unfamiliar, for reasons of you're new to the show in Arizona, or living under a rock, or just tuning out nonsense, which is fine and just. The Cliff's Notes version of this is that the majority of the Arizona State Senate believed one or more things on this list here. One, Trump did not lose the presidential election, which is false. Two, there was election fraud, also false. And three, another audit. Yeah, this election was actually audited by actual experts before this one, but that's neither here nor there to these people. Would restore the faith of the disgruntled Trump supporters who think that the election was stolen. And that is just flat out naive, in my view. And all of this, depending on who you ask in the Republican caucus of the Arizona State Senate, being in the majority, and the Democrats were all pretty much unified opposed to this, led to them wanting to have an audit conducted to vindicate their views. And this is the kind of the summarized version of the story here that I just gave. It's a little more complicated than that, but we don't have time.
I mean, if we were going to explain the whole thing, I think that would take an entire episode of the show, if I'm being honest.
It would.
Like, where would you even begin? Where do you even start?
I don't know. I really don't.
You know what? Actually, for that, go to our previous episodes. Gideon, like he said, has been talking about this for a while.
Yes, I have. Unfortunately, this stuff does not stop. But anyways, at least part one of it has stopped.
Part one? Oh, you mean it's not actually over?
Oh, no, I'm getting there. So why on earth do I mention this completely false and nonsensical audit? It is not being done by anyone who knows anything. Let's be honest. So, Cyber Ninjas, the questionable and unqualified pro-Trump firm conducting the audit, has released their three-volume and 110-page report, according to the Arizona Republic. And that report said a lot of different things. The biggest thing is that the results confirm what has been confirmed by far more credible people. President Joe Biden and U.S. Senator Mark Kelly won Maricopa County, and the numbers the county reported were just about correct. The Cyber Ninja's numbers actually have Biden gaining more votes over Trump as compared to the county's own numbers. And that's not atypical for any kind of recount, for lots of different reasons. Okay, that's not all, though. That is almost never all.
It's never all when you hope it's all, if that makes sense.
Of course. So the draft report said the election results were, quote unquote, inconclusive. That is just nonsense. I'm just going to call it nonsense here. I'm going to just completely debunk that before I even get into the whole discussion segment here. Also, it recommended changes to state election laws and asked the state attorney general to investigate mail-in ballots from voters moving in and out of the state before voter registration deadlines and allegations that more ballots were returned than sent out. The Cyber Ninja CEO, Doug Logan, has also said that there is far more to come. This, again, I really want to emphasize, is just going to be nonsense. Those allegations they're making to the Attorney General Mark Brnovich are nonsense, and there being more is also nonsense. I'm seriously no tolerance for this stuff. Anyhow, elections experts from all over the country have already said, even before the report was released, that anything the report said should be taken with a pound of salt, as many called their methods sloppy, insecure, lacking bipartisan oversight, and were unlikely to be accurate. And the Cyber Ninjas are still not handing over their emails and records from the audit that were ordered by a court to be released to the public. Okay, with all that said, I should ask the panel here, what do you think is next? Or just, what are your thoughts?
Where do we even start? You know, I'm going to let our guest go ahead.
Oh, God. Honestly, I'm just so speechless because I don't think this will ever really end. I mean, if no one is convinced by now that the election was fair and accurate and all of that, they're not going to be convinced later. I think that unfortunately we have just two sides that are just so dug in to, their thoughts and their ideologies that at this point, there's just no way to get them out from there. I'd like to be a little bit more positive than that, but it's just the truth of the situation. Hopefully, at least this will, you know, I don't think that anyone will support a second audit. At least I hope not. I think that really what's going to be the focus is changing laws. Which will unfortunately probably include changing laws for the worse to disenfranchise people rather than enfranchise them.
Yeah, and I think Sarah, you said a lot of what I was thinking too. This push for new laws does not look like it's going to produce anything that is going to make the voter system more friendly, because the fact is in this country, we actually make it in many cases far too difficult for people to vote, which might be something you go like, wait, what? No. And we disenfranchise an absurd amount of people for, like, even before you get to people that can vote, there's a lot of people that can't because they have a felony on their record. And that's true in all states except for Vermont and Maine, and also DC got rid of that too recently, being, I think, the first state to actually overturn felony disenfranchisement. Well, D.C. is not a state, but yeah, the first jurisdiction in the United States to ever overthrow felony disenfranchisement, actually, to my knowledge. So, and yeah, it's not like our...
It's not a great time. I mean, as far as I'm aware, Puerto Rico still can't vote for the presidency at all. We actually still don't even have representation in Congress, even though we're subjected to pretty much anything that Congress decides. They treat us like a state, but with no rights, which is.
Yeah. The term that's used for Puerto Rico and other places that are a part of the United States that are like it is territory. But I am personally prefer calling it colony because that's what it is.
It really does feel that way a lot of the times, especially like. You couldn't see before, but I was just shaking my head in abject defeat because having seen so many of my family members and just people who I see and say, oh, those are my people suffering because of the decisions of a government that they have no say in. It's really, really difficult. And it's really frustrating knowing that the only way for us to get any kind of enfranchisement is a whole nother set of challenges. But even in the States, like you said, it's incredibly difficult for certain groups of people to get that enfranchisement, especially homeless people. Mm-hmm. They have such a hard time voting because in a lot of states, you need a photo ID. And photo IDs are either A, driver's licenses, or B, state IDs cost money. And to get a state ID, you typically need evidence of your citizenship in the state, which usually includes things like mail or a passport, which also costs money. And to get mail, you have to have an address. So it's kind of this catch 22. I don't even really know what to call it, but it's this terrible cycle that keeps people disenfranchised. It's just awful.
Yeah, it's horrible. And we've talked, this is territory this show has tread on many occasions between the audit, talking about voting rights generally, because it is something that I take a lot of interest in, and it is unfortunate that things stink as much, and people are seemingly going to try to make it worse. I mean, you have Arizona already in one move, you know, eliminated the permanent part of the permanent early voting list. And as I'm in Arizona and I vote here, and, you know, like most Arizonans, I receive my ballot in the mail on the permanent early voting list. And that is, and the new rule is, I think it's like if you miss two or three elections, Sarah, do you recall this?
I think it is something within that amount.
Yeah, I forget the exact number.
I can check for you, though.
Yeah, I think it's two or three consecutive elections you miss them and you're off the list now, which sounds facially like, okay, what's the point? It's like, no, the point is bureaucratic nonsense. To just one more, you know, hindrance, one more hurdle to jump in the process, which, yeah, and I think that's the kind of general strategy that's been, from what I've seen, has been taken in other states too, basically death by 1,000 hurdles.
What's really interesting about this entire situation is that things like the permanent early voting list and mail-in voting was and still is incredibly popular in Arizona, especially within our like elderly population, which most often like vote Republican. So it's very interesting to see this change within this past election, because proposing that, you know, before 2020, I mean, I don't think anyone would have really supported you very much on it.
Actually, I do recall, if my memory serves me right here, and I'm drawing from just the incredible pool of memory I have here on this. So if I recall, before 2020, the one person I saw in state politics advocating it was Michelle Ugenti Rita, a state senator from Scottsdale, who basically lost on this issue all the time. No one wanted to hear it.
I'm sorry, to clarify, to get rid of it?
Yeah, to get rid of the permanent early voting list. She was actually the, I believe, one of the lead co-sponsors mm-hmm. on that bill that did it in the end. And that's been a pet project of hers for a while. She's currently running for Secretary of State, for those of you unfamiliar. So you might be hearing more about her soon. So, yeah. Yeah, it's not a popular idea at all. I'm almost certain if you were to, there's attempts by progressive groups to get that law on the ballot. We'll see how that goes. I believe ballot petitions are all due next week. So it is the mad dash by anybody who wants to get a referendum or an mm-hmm. initiative done to get stuff for the 2022 ballot.
To answer what you were previously asking, they changed it to remove voters from the list if they don't use their early ballot at least once in two straight two-year election cycles. So basically, if you haven't voted within the last 4 years, you're out. Which, I mean, maybe I'm trying to think of a positive side to it. Maybe it will encourage people to vote in the midterm elections. But honestly, I just see that it's just going to cause more difficulty for people and for people trying to encourage people to vote, which is, you know, I wish that every politician would want to encourage more people to vote and encourage a wider electorate. But unfortunately, that's just not the case in Arizona.
No, that's not. It's an unfortunate part of not only our state's politics, but just American politics generally. There's a whole lot of people in American politics that are basically who take the basic position. They might not explicitly say this, but the basic position of, well, we don't care if people don't vote, really.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you think about it, the people who founded this country understood that those who vote are the people who have the power. So if they want their group to have the power, they want to encourage them to vote and make it easy for that group to vote. But if they do not want a certain group to have power, then they'll do everything in their power to make sure that they don't vote. I mean, let's go back to, I mean, in the Constitution, who was given the right to vote? It was the wealthy, white, straight men. I mean,
yeah,
white men. And that was very deliberate because they only wanted that group to have that power. And it's difficult to see how that isn't happening today. Because, I mean, think about how there are all these, you know, there's these little like minutiae in these laws, and you can tell that it's to target certain populations. The reason they're doing this, as I said, was to make sure that those populations don't have influence, that they don't have power, because they'll take the power. In their eyes, it'll take power away from them.
Exactly. No, it's the same thing. And to those people who might go like, well, you know, America's constantly moving forward and progressing. Counterexample, have any of you ever learned about Reconstruction? Because that's a really good example of how things moved forward in the immediate aftermath of the Civil War. Things started to actually move forward. You know, the passing of the Civil War amendments. Black men were finally able to vote in the United States.
Yeah.
Of course, women wouldn't even get the vote at the national level till 1919, which is another separate issue.
It's not just women. We also didn't allow Native American people to vote until, I believe, like maybe after World War II or during it.
Oh, it was well into the mid-1900s, yeah. If I'm remembering right. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just like a darn shame. And why I bring up Reconstruction specifically is like, mm-hmm. yeah, things were progressing, at least as far as almost universal male suffrage, at least, which stepped forward from what was prior to the war. And what happened, for any of you who know anything about American history, know that was put in the bud through violence and terrorism. The first Klan was, in fact, a terrorist group. I've seen some people call them America's first terrorist group.
Yeah.
And quickly, for clarification, according to the Library of Congress, Native Americans were given the full like access to voting in 1924 because of the Snyder Act. It basically had admitted Native Americans born in the U.S. to full U.S. citizenship. It's a little late there, late in the game.
I was off by two decades, but
no, but
yeah, it's
still
bad.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly, and there's a lot that can be. So much more than we can say on this. And I've once again, you can listen to prior episodes of the show. We've talked about this with the panel previously. But yeah, it is in my view, a darn shame that, you know, that there isn't an agreement on something as so fundamental as that. And there's reasons why. That's a whole nother episode. So I guess. Yeah, thank you all so much, and I'm going to hand it off to Kirsten to talk about her story.
Okay, so last week, if you listened in, or at any point during the week on your favorite podcasting platform, which you should totally go find the Review Squared on and leave us a review, leave us some positive, I don't know, maybe some love over there. But definitely, if you had listened to our previous episode at all, you'd be familiar with our discussion on the Gabby Petito case. And honestly, if you've had internet access or have interacted with other human beings at any point during the week, you probably know a decent amount about this case. So in case you forgot somehow, or somehow you just haven't, you've been living under an actual rock for the past week or so, I will give a little refresher right about here. So Gabby Petito left her home in Long Island with her fiancé, Brian Laundrie, for a road trip on July 2nd across the country. They were planning on visiting all kinds of national parks and hiking and living this quote-unquote van life that's been kind of a popular aesthetic on social media lately. And so Gabby had actually quit her job to document this trip and to start a travel blog. And on August 9th, the Utah police responded to a report of what has been called a quote-unquote domestic problem. And this report followed what police documents referred to as some sort of argument. And now there's been a lot of conjecture and speculation about how this particular argument or a conflict went down. But just 3 days later, it seemed as though things were still tense between the couple because there was body cam footage released from a traffic stop that occurred on the 12th, wherein both Gabby and Brian called it a tough morning for them. The couple ended up spending the night separately from one another, Gabby staying in the van and laundry into a hotel, laundry being Brian's last name. But sometime between the 23rd and 24th, Gabby's parents said they last spoke directly with Gabby over FaceTime. Then at about that same time, just around it, she and Brian would have been getting ready to start leaving Utah and go off to visit a national park in Wyoming. Now, the last text message allegedly sent from Gabby's phone was sent to her mother and simply said, "No service in Yosemite." And I didn't, like, realize this fully last time we spoke about it, but that's especially odd considering that Yosemite is not in Wyoming, and that's where they were meant to be headed. That's where Brian was allegedly seen in the following days. So it's odd that she would have texted that, but it's just something to note. A day before the last text from Gabby's phone, a woman on TikTok claimed that she and her boyfriend had given Brian a ride because he was hitchhiking, but this woman claims that he was alone. And this same woman has said that she's been in contact, her and her boyfriend both been in contact with authorities, and this is considered to be a pretty credible source as far as that event goes. But obviously, social media, we can't verify that fully. It's worth noting, though. Then 2 days later, on September 1st, Brian returned to his home in Northport, Florida, still alone. Gabby was reported missing by her family on September 11th. Just 3 days later, on the 14th, Brian was last seen leaving his parents' home. And so here's the updated information that we didn't have last time we talked about this on the show. So, according to CNN, one source has indicated that Brian left behind his keys, or his wallet and cell phone, rather. His parents said he indicated that he may have been heading to a nature reserve to go hike alone, and this is where authorities have been searching for the past 6 days or so for Brian. Gabby's remains were found Sunday near the Wyoming National Park she and Brian had been visiting, and an autopsy performed Tuesday confirmed that this was, in fact, her. And all we know as of right now in terms of details from the autopsy is that a coroner has determined the initial manner of death to be homicide. 4 days ago, and it's also important to note quickly, manner of death is different than cause of death. Your manner of death might be homicide. Your cause of death would be a method of performing a homicide, if that makes sense. It's important to note. Regardless, 4 days ago, authorities executed a search warrant on Brian's home, and during this search, they seized his car and had a hard drive that was seized as well, that one source says could contain evidence that a felony has been committed. Just yesterday, a warrant was issued by a federal court for Brian's arrest, and specifically, he has been indicted in a Wyoming district court for the unauthorized use of a debit card to make unauthorized withdrawals worth more than $1,000 during the time Gabby had been missing. So far, authorities are still calling him a person of interest in the case, both of her disappearance and her untimely death. And if you listened last time, you'll already know that this means he has not officially been named as a suspect, the important distinction between a suspect and person of interest being that a person of interest is just somebody that authorities or investigators think may have information important to whatever they're investigating. The search for Brian is still ongoing, so if you see or know anything, please do your due diligence and contact investigators. If you want to do so anonymously, there are avenues to do that, so please, please, please do not let that stop you. So I'll open it up here for both of your thoughts on this case. There's been a lot of conversation around this, obviously, and there's even been conversation about how much this case has been covered as well. It's been mentioned hundreds of times in a week. I saw on one source that I couldn't write down before I had closed the tab by accident, but there was one source that noted that her case had been mentioned several hundred times on the same stations in just the course of over 7 days.
Wait, you're kidding. I knew this was a big story, but my goodness.
Hundreds of times. And it all speaks to this phenomena that's also been brought up, which isn't new, by the way. This has been something that in the true crime community has been discussed time and time and time again. This phenomena known as missing white woman syndrome, which is essentially just the cultural fascination that we have specifically in America, but also countries similar to America, where when a white woman or white young girl goes missing, there is this odd fascination around it, and there's this obsession around it. Whereas when other people, like women of color, men of color, people of color, or disabled people, or older people, or just about anybody who doesn't look like Gabby Petito goes missing, it doesn't seem that it gets that much attention, which is no detriment, I'll say up front, to Gabby or her case. She didn't ask to go missing. She didn't ask for any of this, and neither did her family. It's more of an observation culturally, I would say.
Yeah, definitely. And we were talking about this a little bit before we came up. And actually, Sarah, you want to take this part, what you were telling us?
Yeah. I mean, I've been interested in van life for a while now. So I, as someone who kind of follows that community, I learned about it through that community. So I've known about it for a while now. But it was very interesting to me how quickly it blew up. You know, I thought that maybe it was just because she was a social media kind of personality. And, you know, if someone's able to, you know, you're able to see her life play out on Instagram and on her account. So I thought that maybe that was what was playing a role in this public fascination that was going on. But, you know, once I learned about the missing white girl syndrome, missing white woman syndrome.
Yeah, I think it's pretty fairly interchangeable. Yeah. We still know what you mean.
Yeah, it made a lot more sense. And what I brought up earlier, just with the group before we were on air, is the case of, I believe it's Daniel Robinson. And this is something that I've seen actually show up a couple times in recent months on my Twitter feed, for example. And what happened was, this is an Arizona man who went missing a while ago. He was a geologist and, you know, described as happy-go-lucky. He was very positive, very, you know, there wasn't any signs of, like, I guess, depression or anything or any mental health issues from anyone else in his life until the day that he went missing. He was acting very strangely. And basically, he was last seen by a coworker in June in a site near Buckeye, Arizona. So this is a very, you know, close to home case. And because of the discussion with Gabby Petito, the positive thing is that his case has been brought up. When everyone's talking about the other victims, he's someone who a lot of people are talking about now, which is great. I just wish that back in June, when he was first reported by his father, that, you know, people were talking about it just as much as they are now.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's the perfect way to phrase it almost, where it's not that it's anything to do with Gabby or her specific case, but that it's just this wish for people to have cared before we were having this conversation to begin with due to her case. But I think it is definitely something very positive that's come out of this. And it's important, I think, in these cases to seek the positive, because this is incredibly tragic, the whole thing. And just in general, I think it's been really hopeful in a way. The way that we've now said, you know what, as a community, our response is going to be to uplift these cases as opposed to doubling down on this family's grief and somehow turning it around, where I feel like that's definitely been the internet's response to other stories like this. And another thing that I've seen brought up in response to this as well has been, once again, the phenomena of missing and murdered Indigenous women, where that's incredibly prevalent, especially here in Arizona. I've talked about it on the show before. Go back and listen to that episode, because I said more in there than I have time to today. But that's it's incredibly important, I think, just to look out for each other.
Yeah.
At the end of the day.
I couldn't say it better. Mm-hmm. Kirsten, that is the that's it. We just need to look out for each other.
It's the sentiment I feel like we leave off with a lot of times when it comes to true crime. I think a lot of people who are drawn to true crime, myself included, are drawn to it because it's this sense of empathy and it's this sense of coming together as a community to protect one another and get justice for those of us who we couldn't protect. That I think is what we need to come together and really focus on now.
Yeah, y'all have really just taken the words out of my mouth tonight.
Sorry.
I just want to mention that I recommend, if you're interested in this, in following the Navajo Times. They do post a lot of missing cases reports. I know, like, the other day they posted one about, I believe it was, like, 4 children. Thank God that they were found.
Oh, okay.
But, yeah, they were found, I believe, that same day. But if you're someone who really wants to at least try to help find some people, especially within that community, I recommend following them and, you know, retweeting what they post out and just please make sure that you're engaging in the issues of the Navajo Nation and other reservations here in Arizona.
Absolutely. And I think to that point as well, this case has also demonstrated so handily how powerful our impact is just by retweeting something, just by saying, hey, this is important, or hey, this person is missing. Please be on the lookout for them. It makes all the difference, especially in terms of looking out for each other like that, which, yeah.
Yeah. No, I couldn't. Once again, could not say it better.
Exactly.
The words have been taken out of my mouth, which doesn't happen every week. So, yeah. Anyways, I think we should take a really quick break. We will be back with the Review Squared on Blaze Radio and BlazeRadioOnline.com. Stay tuned. Well, we're back on the Review Squared on Blaze Radio and BlazeRadioOnline.com, continuing to be live from the Bill Austin Radio Studio in downtown Phoenix. It's a little past, it's getting closer to quarter to the hour, top of the hour, so we're getting closer to the end.
Yes, sir. And selfish, I don't know. It's not my show that I'm promoting, so I don't know if I can say this. But 2 shows on our station that I'm a big fan of and that you just heard the promos for. Pop 48 is on every Monday at 10, and Storyboard is on every Tuesday at 8. And they are both just phenomenal shows with phenomenal people behind them. I cannot recommend that you listen to them enough. The K-pop stan in me, the absolute nerd in me loves Pop 48. So if that sounds like you, definitely tune in.
Yes, absolutely. If you're listening on the podcast version, you can't hear those promos because I removed them. But yes, if you are listening live. But yes, I agree. Do listen to those shows on Blaze Radio and BlazeRadioOnline.com. By the way, I'm Gideon Kariuki if you're just joining us on the Review Squared.
And if you're just joining us, I'm also Kirsten Dorman. That doesn't really change.
And yes, and we continue to have our guest panelist here, Sarah Nelson, and Dublin,
hi.
Who's under the table.
Guest panelists, plural, thank you.
Yes. So I'm going to hand it over for the last segment tonight to Sarah to kind of talk about what she has to share with us tonight.
Yeah, just to give a little bit of context about who I am, I was born and raised in downtown Phoenix. I lived here when it was not so fun to live here, and I've lived here, you know, I still live here now. So I know a lot about this community, and I follow a lot of what's going on here. So one thing that I kind of wanted to talk about on the show today was a recent event which hasn't gotten much press, but I think that I like to use this event as a starting off point for a conversation. So 2 weeks ago, last Friday, I believe, around 1 a.m., the Phoenix police got a call from 2 individual people who mentioned that there was a man walking in the median lane of 7th Avenue, walking down the street completely naked. And of course, the police responded very quickly. They were able to, apprehend the man, handcuff him. And then they laid him on the ground, put what's called kind of, it's kind of like this, I guess, mesh, like, hood to prevent the person from spitting. And then they also tied up and restrained his legs. And then they moved him on his side so he would, you know, there wouldn't be pressure on any breathing area. And then after a couple minutes, they had him sit on the curb of the street. And unfortunately, between the time of him being moved to the curb of the street and the fire department getting there, he became unconscious. And he died while being transported to the hospital. So that happened 2 weeks ago. And at the time I was, let me just state, is I live very close to where this incident occurred. At the time I was, you know, I was awake actually. And I, you know, I remember seeing the sirens and, you know, the flashing blue and red lights. But being from downtown Phoenix, you kind of start to not think very much of it, unfortunately. It was only until that morning when the street was still blocked off and my father mentioned something to me that I started looking into what actually happened and I learned of this case. So what the Phoenix Police Department does is that after 2 weeks, they will release what's called a critical incident briefing. So that's kind of an edited video of the police body camera footage from, you know, multiple points of view. And then it'll often be like a spokesperson or someone working in their PR, public affairs department, kind of explaining what's going on. So since today was 2 weeks after that occurring, they released it. And it's obviously, it was a very edited video. You can't, you know, they don't show everything. It's not every single angle. It's not the length of the entire event, but they show the key moments of that body camera footage. And I can say from what I saw that it seems like everything, they followed policy, that his death wasn't a result of something like police brutality or any use of force. But I'd still like to, I still wanted to mention this because I think that it brings up a very important part of policing that I feel has been ignored. Many of you are probably aware of this, but in August of this year, it was released that the Phoenix Police Department and then also the city in general was being investigated by the United States Department of Justice, basically for, they're investigating a couple things, but mainly the excessive and deadly use of force, how the police handled protesters and the journalists covering them, discriminatory policies. So those are really in relationship to the Black Lives Matter movement. But there's also the city's response to people with disabilities and then the police's response to homeless people, which I think that the discussion of the Black Lives Matter movement is incredibly important. And I'm very glad that over the past couple of years we've been having this discussion. I just think that it's also important to look at number 4 and number 5. And I wish that we also included, the treatment of disabled people and the treatment of homeless people when we're talking about issues regarding policing. I think in this case, it's very clear that the man who died was either suffering from some type of, unfortunately, like mental health episode, or he was under the influence of something. They haven't released the cause of death yet, but that seems to be the two kind of leads for what happened. And I think that oftentimes when there's something like this that occurs, when there is a person, in an unstable situation, I think our first response is to, hey, let's call the police. But we have to think that maybe if instead of the police being called, if the EMTs were called, if he would still be alive right now. So I think the entire point of kind of sharing this story is discussing just the role that policing plays. I don't think that in downtown Phoenix we should be having police officers respond to, a mental health situation. I don't think that it should be the police who are directly dealing with homeless people. I think that it should be individuals like trained social workers, like EMT, like members of the fire department, instead of police officers. Because those are the people who have the tools and are able to, I guess, you know, who are able to, I guess, provide people, not, I mean, the police, don't get me wrong, they do provide resources for people, but I think that this would just be more efficient and you'd be more able to save more lives.
Right. This kind of thing, mental health counseling or mm-hmm. providing first aid to people who are overdosing and things like that, is a little bit out of, from my understanding, out of depth for the training that police receive.
Exactly.
And so we have a few different solutions, I think, in front of us when it comes to this. One of those being what you suggested. One of those being training police more to be able to respond to situations like this appropriately. And then we're met with a lot of hurdles,
yeah,
if you will. I'm taking a few classes from the Watts College here at ASU, and a lot of those classes are taught by law enforcement or people involved with law enforcement. And I'm curious to know, settling firmly into my role as a journalism student, I'm curious to ask the two of you who study policy what your thoughts are on the take that I've heard from some of my instructors in the Watts College, where their take has been, well, if you want police to respond properly and have the proper training, you need to pay them more. Where is that money coming from? And then the alternative response of, well, if you want social workers or whoever else to respond, A, that's unsafe for them, and B, they're also not paid enough. And so I would love to know, as people who think about this stuff a lot, what is your take on that response?
Well, I'm just going to be quite frank here. At least as let's deal with this in each part. So
right.
Let's start with the pay cops more point. The cops are already paid a lot. I do not think people realize this. If you advance anywhere below, beyond like the lowest position in any force, you start actually making very good money. Yeah. Sarah's nodding her head furiously.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, like, and you advance anywhere in the police hierarchy, you start actually making real money really fast. I feel like that is a very common misconception. Now, that's not universally true, but that is, at least as far as big city police departments, which Phoenix is, that is true.
Right.
And that's okay. That's point number one. So they're already paid a lot in most cases.
So allow me to interrupt you with another question, because this is me, again, settling very firmly into my role as a question asker, I guess. So let's say we do pay the police more. Would you then be comfortable, or do you think communities would be comfortable with having them go into these situations even with the proper training?
No, I don't think so. And I think that goes into the point I really wanted to make, as Sarah was talking about this, was, you know, with having police respond to things like this, if you have a hammer, everything's a nail situation. It's the, mm-hmm. if all you have is police, well, what are you going to do? You're going to use police.
Mm-hmm.
And that is just the way I think about problems and how to solve them. It's, you have to think holistically. You have to think about the entire problem from start to finish. Like, by the time you're reaching, you hope to not even reach the point where somebody is on the street in that kind of situation. You have to completely
exactly.
prevent it.
Yes. And this does sound a lot like fitting a square peg into a circle.
Yeah.
Hole.
Exactly. I just don't think it's the appropriate response. And to address the other part, you know, we should pay social workers aren't paid enough. Well, that is true. We should pay them more. I feel like that's transparently true. You know,
it's, I think, a pretty well-known fact that social workers are severely overworked and underpaid, and there are not enough of them.
Yeah. So, yeah, no, it's just, the whole thing is you want to, once again, address the problem before it even becomes a quote-unquote actual problem where you have people responding to that kind of emergency. And that means building up the kind of systems where we're taking care of people's mental health from the very start before you have people in such emergencies. And mm-hmm. that will hopefully make it easier for us to deal with actual mental health emergencies when those do happen, because unfortunately that does still happen.
Yeah, I think promoting proactive solutions is incredibly important. But I also think that, you know, when you call 911, you kind of get two options. You either get the police to come to you or the fire department to come to you. Why is it not that when you call 911 that you can't get a social worker to come to you? I think that that should be, I mean, that's something that would be very easy to implement, in my opinion. Obviously, it's much more complex than that, but we already have part of our infrastructure there. I mean, it would be great to see like departments being formed in cities where that could be a legitimate response, you know, where there's an entire active department of social workers or critical situation responders who are separate from the police department, who are able to come in with that de-escalation training, who know a lot about disabled issues and how to, for example, interact with someone who has, you know, autism, for example. Mm-hmm. Because we've seen a lot of instances where, to be quite frank, police officers just don't know what to do. They don't know how to respond, and it can be a very stressful situation for the person that they're interacting with. I think that it's just, I think that we just need to think about solutions. When we're thinking of active solutions, the people to respond, we shouldn't just, our first thought should not be, let's call the police. I think that we've seen many cases of where that has not worked. And I think that if we can, you know, what is that one saying? When you the definition of insanity is trying
it's
things.
Insanity and stupidity interchangeably in that one. Yeah.
Yeah. The definition of his insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results,
exactly.
Which is commonly attributed to Einstein.
Exactly.
Right.
So why do we expect to call 911, ask for the police, and for things to go any differently? I think that, I guess what I'm proposing is that we should be able to call 911 and get a social worker on hand, get someone who is trained, someone who will come in without a gun, you know, someone whose first thought isn't, you know, defensive measures.
Right. Yeah. You don't want to escalate things to there if you can help it. That is that in to me, my idea of a quote unquote civilized society, I hate that term, but that's the term people use. My idea of it, if we are to have one, is like, well, maybe we don't respond to every single problem with unholy amounts of violence.
Yeah.
Right. And I mean, to that point as well, I am looking at some stats. The Treatment Advocacy Center, they did a study back in 2015 that's cited in a lot of different reports and things that talk about this, where they found that though they number fewer than 1 in 50 U.S. adults, individuals with untreated severe mental illness are involved in at least 1 in 4, but as many as half of all fatal police shootings. And that was in 2015.
Mm-hmm. My goodness.
And the fact that we've had such a severe uptick in mental health crises in 2020 and 2021 as a kind of side effect or symptom of the pandemic, I can only imagine that that has not improved.
Probably not. And that is horrible. It is.
To give you an idea of the scale of this.
Yeah, no, mm-hmm. we do need to do better. We need to be able to question our current structure and be able to say this isn't working, because the fact is that this isn't working. That like I feel like those of you who might not be familiar with how DOJ investigations get launched, if you get a Department of Justice investigation coming from DC to investigate your town's police department, that normally means they have seen a lot of things just completely go wrong. Like, for reference, in most cities, it tends to be high-profile police deaths that trigger these things. So, yeah, never a good sign, and it is, in my view, a tragedy that the city council is just kind of sitting around, smiling about it, going, everything's fine. No, it is not, Mayor Gallego. Not everything is fine. This is not great at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I've been someone who, I've sat in a lot of conversations with city leaders, you know, with mayors and council people, and I've even been in one with the chief of police. And the unfortunate thing is, you know, the answer that's always been proposed is like, yes, we're working on providing more police officers in those areas so we can respond to things quicker. You guys, that's not what we need. Having more police officers is not going to get rid of the problem of homelessness that we have. All it's doing is just pushing homeless people into other places and pushing them, you know, in less public areas. That's, the cops just taking down their tents and moving them to shelters. That's not really doing much. What we need is more resources. The cops, that's not more resources.
No, that is not, like, the problem of homelessness, to all of you listening, is that they don't have places to, like, they don't have permanent shelter.
Exactly.
So, and by the way, this is not exactly some crazy radical idea. This has been proposed by conservatives too, actually. Mm-hmm. The idea of housing first, the get them in homes, in stable housing, because shelters are not a permanent solution. That shelters are very temporary. You need shelter now, but get them into supportive housing where you can help people, especially those on the streets who might have mental health issues, might have substance abuse issues. Mm-hmm. Get on their feet, because they can't get on their feet when they're on the streets.
It's
That's
really
not possible.
It's difficult to. There's a lot of barriers and hurdles that specifically prevent people without addresses from overcoming that. And I think to your point of having the shelters here, it's great that we have shelters, but like you said, I don't think it can be a final solution. When I was reporting on a story about how difficult it is for the homeless population here in Phoenix to vote, or the homeless population in any major city to vote during presidential elections specifically, I was calling around to a lot of shelters in Phoenix and I couldn't get anyone on the phone, because all that plays on the phones when you call most of those places is, hey, sorry, we're full, but you can try looking at other places or get on a wait list.
Yeah, and that's a tragedy. It doesn't need to be like this. These are deliberate choices that have been made by those in power, and it's not great.
It feels like we end a lot of our shows with that kind of sentiment.
Yeah, unfortunately we have. Before we go, one last thing. I do want to turn to Sarah. First of all, thanks for coming on.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I've had a lot of fun.
This has been great. I've had so much fun. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Yeah, and I do want to say, Sarah and I, along with our friend Cammy Parrish, are currently working on a podcast that you might be seeing soon on Blaze.
We are.
So, yes, I'll talk about that when it comes out. We actually recorded our first, like, two episodes, mm-hmm. so... look forward to that. We'll promote it on our own socials too.
It's been very fun. If you like this, you'll like it too.
Exactly.
Oh, for sure. I can't recommend it enough. Not only are these two wonderful, but Cammy is also just a gem. So go listen to their podcast or else.
Yes, and we'll let you know about that when it is finally ready to go. And Sarah, do you have anything you want to promote? Anything you want to say before we sign off?
Oh wow. At this time now, should I just, like, plug my Twitter or something?
Yeah, you're allowed to. Yeah. Feel free.
You can, if you want to, I guess, reach me anywhere, I'm at Hey Sarah Nelson. I'd also want to say hi to Cammy Parrish, because I know she's listening right now.
No way.
She says hi to you as well.
Oh, goodness.
Well, I think it's time to do a hi and goodbye, is it not?
Yes, it is. So before we go, as always, thank you for listening to the Review Squared on Blaze Radio and BlazeRadioOnline.com.
Follow us on Twitter, too.
Yes, at @review_squared on Twitter and Instagram. Please follow us. We do interact on there. And want to say, if you're listening to us wherever you get podcasts, great. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, etc. If you get podcasts there, we are on it.
Yes.
And yeah, that's basically it. Listen to us next week, Fridays at 7 p.m. live on BlazeRadioOnline.com. Thank you so much. Have a wonderful week. Thank you, Sarah, for coming tonight, and we do hope to have you again.
And thank you also to our other guest panelist.
Yes, and our guest panelist, Dublin, who has been
hiding
under the desk here. I'm looking right at him.
Being wonderful, actually.
Oh, yeah. He's had a great time napping.
Yes. So, yeah, thank you all so much. Have a great week. I encourage everyone to not do anything too stupid. Enjoy the fall weather. It's finally falling into the 90s in Phoenix.
Have yourself a little PSL.
Exactly. Okay, that's it. Bye. The song at the start of the episode is Dedicated to the Press by Betty Davis, and the music you hear is by Springtime.